Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by historian and author Myron Sugarman. Myron discusses his early beginnings in Newark, talks about his connection with connected people, shares his experience as a fighter against anti-Semitism, and explains why we need modern-day Minutemen. Also, how the rabbis spent their yeshiva week, plus how to respond to Whoopi Goldberg's recent comments about the Holocaust. And should Jewish organizations be teaching self-defense? All this and more Behind the Bima.
Okay, everybody, welcome to Behind the Bima. Guess we're live. Not really sure where Rabbi Goldberg just went, but I'm sure it's an emergency. You don't realize what it's like if you're a rabbi.
Apologize, a little technical problem.
I just said you had an emergency, you know, the life of the rabbi. So
there you go. It is Wednesday night at 9 p.m., and we are here to take you
Behind the Bima.
We are here to take you Behind the Bima. Thank you back. I am here with Rabbi Josh Brody. We have a fantastic guest tonight, the great Myron Sugarman, Pop Sugarman, the one and only Mr. Sugarman. Amazing life story to tell. We're looking forward to having that conversation and bringing it to you. But I want to first mention our sponsor. Tonight's program, tonight's episode of Behind the Bima is dedicated for a complete, speedy, and painless refuah shleima, full recovery to children in our community who we are all praying for and rooting for and pulling for. Esther Tehila Bas Ariel Tzipora, Carmel Shai Ben Reza. And we, please God, look forward to hearing good news about both for a speedy recovery. And towards that end, we will mention, we ask everyone to turn their heartfelt prayers. Our dear colleague and friend, Rabbi Moskowitz, is right now focused on his beautiful, beloved daughter, Esti, who had a major surgery. She's recovering well, but needs our prayers and continues to recover. So please have her in mind. We are for every single class we give and every learning opportunity. Esther Tehila Bas Ariel Tzipora. And we love Rabbi Moskowitz. And of course, he's taking the space that he needs. We ask all of you to please pray and do good things and have her in mind. And please, God, hopefully he'll be back quickly. She'll be back full speed, full strength soon and quickly. And we pray for that. So Rabbi Brody, Yeshiva week. You took off last week for Yeshiva week.
That's right. It wasn't as much of a break as I thought it would end up being, but
what was your yeshiva week?
Yeah, it was nice. It's just, first of all, it's nice to spend some quality time with the family. But again, we were supposed to be in Israel, so a week vacation turned into like a day vacation. But even that wasn't so much of a vacation. I'm looking forward to the summer. That's the next vacation. But it was good. It's good that the kids are off and they get to enjoy. And now get to be back at school with no masks. That's also a big deal. Everyone's excited about that.
New policy at some of the schools.
New developments.
Here.
Yeah. I think all the schools, right? I think all the local Jewish day schools are.
I think all the local Orthodox Jewish day schools.
Right.
Donna Klein,
yeah. I'm not sure yet. We have actually a meeting tomorrow. We'll find out.
Yeah.
But it's definitely
interesting development, promising development. Hopefully we're coming out of Omicron and turning a corner. And of course, we remain vigilant and careful. And of course, we understand the dangers, and hopefully it represents turning a corner to a new time.
And you? Okay. A little yeshiva break?
Got away for a couple days. I will not say the location because it was phenomenal. We drove. It was Florida-based, but not a lot of yeshiva weekers. So we are not disclosing it because we'd like to keep it that way. let everyone continue to descend upon Orlando and elsewhere. We're keeping this place to ourselves. It was not heavily populated by Yeshiva Week vacationers. It's a place that has a couple kosher restaurants, beautiful Chabad. We were not nearly inundated, and we were able to really relax and enjoy. And as we've said many times, it was a beautiful family trip. Not sure I'd call it a vacation, but it was a great family trip. Much needed. It's also important, spending time with family, bonding, connecting. It was something which was really important. So it was good. And now we're up to like Yeshivish week. What happens is, I was explaining, I spoke this evening for your wife's outreach program. Simone Brody does a phenomenal job in our community together with her husband doing outreach. Not a lot of Orthodox shuls have dedicated outreach rabbi and Rebbetzin, dedicated page in their weekly bulletin promoting those outreach activities. So there's a great program. You guys have taken how many trips to Israel, men and women?
Many, probably seven trips now.
I've led many trips. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've led many trips to Israel. And as a follow-up, there are ongoing conversations, classes, learning opportunities. So tonight she was doing flour making. I don't mean flour like for bread. I mean flowers like flora for the Shabbos table. And I spoke for a few minutes about the beauty of Shabbos, the reason for Shabbos, how Shabbos liberates us, the ultimate guilt-free snow day once a week, how Shabbos is the payday, the payoff for working hard all week, spoke all about it. So I was explaining to them, I was trying to teach them about Yeshiva week and explain to them. But if somebody doesn't know, never heard of Yeshiva week, like, you can't explain it. Don't leave your house. Don't get out from under your bed. Don't try to find parking. Don't go shopping. And you're out of your mind if you try to go to a restaurant. Right. You're simply out of your mind. The notion of what descends upon us in Yeshiva week, we love it. Our brothers and sisters from elsewhere, they come, they visit. We love it. You know, we have Boker Haton Synagogue has every morning two Sephardic Minyanim. And we also have, let's see, 625, 7, 745, 830, 915. We have a lot of options, right? Well, during Yeshiva week, my office is right off the main shul, and I can hear through the doors, there was a 10, 10:30, 11. just Yeshiva just, week. Yeah, the shul's official minyanim, that doesn't matter.
Right.
It's whatever time you get there, you have enough people, you start a new minyan.
Right.
So, you know, that's the way it goes. Take your life into your hands to go out during Yeshiva week. So that was last week, Yeshiva week. And now it's Yeshivish week, because there's a whole group of schools who don't want to be off when everyone else is off. So therefore, they wait another week.
Right.
So I don't know if you've seen that. Now we have the next wave coming through.
So first of all, the word on the street is that next year, they're going to move it up a week. Have you heard this talk yet?
I heard such a rumor.
There's a rumor going around that maybe it'll be a week earlier to coincide with maybe Yeshiva University's vacation. I don't know. There's a lot of talk out there. So people are all...
I heard such rumors. Yeah. I heard such
rumors. I don't
rumors.
Know. It is a breaking news. Yeah.
It's a big... Florida becomes a big melting pot.
And you got to love the weather. Yeshiva week, the temperature drops from like 75 to 45. And everyone from New York says, oh, it's so great.
I had somebody, while we were away those couple of days, there was somebody visiting from Toronto, a colleague, a rabbi and friend. And he said, his kids are desperate to swim. Do I know anyone with a pool? I said, feel free to go to our home. We're not there. Go right to the backyard. I said, but you do know it's freezing cold. Like, nobody in their right mind would get in a pool. They swam. Those New Yorkers.
They love the other, it.
You know, we've had this cold spell. We're not going to complain, certainly, to people listening to us from elsewhere in the world. But we dipped into the 30s, which is pretty much unheard of in Florida. I put on the heat in my house. Did you put the heat on?
We did, I think, for a day. Or we turned the air conditioner off for a day. I don't know if we put the heat on.
There are a lot of people in Florida who don't even know if they have heat or not. They just have it on the air conditioning setting. They've never used the heat. When you put on the heat, at first it smells like your whole house is burning down before the heat actually kicks in. So we had those cold spells. It almost seems like every year Yeshiva week, they bring down that cold weather into the 30s. So we had this other day where, you know, it was, when I left my house in the morning, it was in the 30s. That's cold for us. So I was wearing a sweater with my suit jacket. It's definitely, it's a look when you have a gray beard you could pull off. It's like a Mr. Rogers kind of, you know, you could pull it off. I actually saw myself in the mirror and I thought, like, who's that old man? And then I realized it was me. Okay. The gray beard with the V-neck sweater tie underneath the suit jacket. It was like all professor, like Rebbe and the Yeshiva Ram look. Really old man look.
I just got to get that cutlass.
Yeah, I startled myself when I walked by the mirror when I saw myself. But anyway, when I came to Mincha, the temperature had risen to 70. Mm. So the people at Mincha were like, you know, short sleeves, people in shorts. It's like, why are you wearing a sweater? I said, I look like an idiot. It was in the 30s this morning. It's twice. The temperature doubled during the day. So we've got the iguanas falling out of trees. It's that time of year when the temperature gets so cold. They fall out of trees and then they thaw out when the temperature comes back to life. So what else is going on, Rabbi Brody, since our last episode two weeks
ago? So much. I'm so excited. Someone got me a gift subscription to this learning program called Chayenu out of Chabad. And I've been studying this for the last 4 days and I'm really enjoying it. I even learned some Yiddish. I'm doing one part. I'm doing this called the Hayom Yom, which is the Rebbe's teachings in Yiddish. Many of them are in Yiddish and they translate it, but I'm trying the Yiddish. Mm. I love it. Chumash and Rashi,
you're like legit. Listen, it happens to be you might be learning Chabad right now.
Yeah.
What rank are you in Sivos Hashem?
See, I haven't entered that yet. I don't know if I'm too old to enter that.
I'm just telling you, I'm just saying, I don't want to like flex here, but you're a private. Ich bin a general.
Ich bin a general. Well, listen to this.
I'm a general.
You're a general. Der alte Rebbe hat einmal gesagt.
Rabbi Brody, you need to grow a beard if you're going to try to play with the Chabad.
I am so excited.
If you're going to try to play with the big boys in Chabad, you're going to have to grow a beard. So there is there is some development and news. You know, we had Rabbi Adlerstein on our program on Behind the Bima. We went Behind the Bima with him, and he spoke a lot about the interfaith that he does at Simon Wiesenthal Center, the difference between interfaith dialogue and cooperation, and the definition of who is a missionary versus an evangelical, and really informative. Got great feedback on that episode. And since then, I do on every other Thursday night, I do a question and answer with someone online with Meaningful Minute, and did one that centered around this, and that video went out pretty wide. And I'm honored to tell you that got several emails of people who apologized for misunderstanding, misrepresenting, and even someone made a video online, a video apology. And the way that came about is they had emailed me saying that, you know, so sorry, I'm one of the people that kind of harassed the shul and wrote cold phone numbers and harassed people. And I spoke out on social media and, hey, I guess I was wrong. So sorry. So I said, thank you. I appreciate that. It takes a big person, but just curious that you used your name when you were out there criticizing and condemning. I noticed you're emailing anonymously privately when you're apologizing. You might want to consider just going on record again. So it took a few days, but to his credit, sent me an email with the YouTube link. He put out a video with his name. And I said, I apologize. I was wrong. Shouldn't call people heretic. And the phenomenon, though, which is worth mentioning, is we've seen this in other areas of life, of people who are radicalized, that there are individuals who use the gift of technology to promote and express fanaticism, and they radicalize innocent people who sit at home and consume that information and emotionally get moved, invested in it, and feel compelled to act. It's possible there's some conversation maybe with figuring out someone who reached out who might have been the one who forged a letter from Rav Schechter. And it's a similar phenomenon along. The similar phenomenon along the way is being radicalized, right? Somewhat naive or innocent people who listen to fanatics spew lies, hatred, slander, and then become radicalized as a result. So on the one hand, gratified by that apology and some of the people who have come to see the truth. On the other hand, we have a lot to be concerned about how easily people are misled, fake news, and easily radicalized to act. And we're lucky that they were radicalized to harass and to spread a false narrative and not to do something much worse and more dangerous. So in that sense, we were lucky, but it is something that we have to worry about and care about.
You know, I love the way he got on this video and made the apology. It wasn't just that my name is so-and-so and I apologize for what I did. But you saw that it wasn't prepared, and he said it wasn't prepared, and he spends about 5 minutes working through, you could see in his own mind, what he did wrong and how he is really regretting what he did and the damage he caused.
And I guess it's a warning, and this is what I would say, what I try to take away from it is that we may all be guilty of it. You know, we have to be educated and really careful and judicious consumers of information. In this information age, where anyone with a keyboard and internet connection can write, post, record, stream anything they want, say anything they want, it's up to us, the consumers, to really be smart and to know and to understand and dissect. And, you know, is this vetted? Is this credible? Is this reviewed? Just because somebody WhatsApped you something, just because you saw it somewhere, doesn't mean it's true. And so the burden is on the producers of information, but the burden is also on the consumers of information to do so judiciously and wisely and correctly. And that's an important lesson to take away.
Well, it's nice to see it. Hopefully there'll be more.
Yeah, I hope so too. I hope so too. Someone's asking that we share it. Maybe we'll put it in the comments here tonight. What else in the news, speaking about misinformation that's out there, I'm kind of embarrassed to share a name with her. And no, many people have asked, but we're not related, Whoopi Goldberg and I. No relation.
Is that a fact? Because some people say that you might be related.
As far as I know, we're not related. Although I saw somebody on Twitter called for Whoopi Goldberg and Rabbi Goldberg to sit down and talk it out.
Well, you've done that before with some professional athletes. You know, you've helped show them.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be happening here. Right. What was your takeaway? As somebody who's led countless trips to Poland and you're well-versed on the Holocaust, and you're an Holocaust educator, March of the Living.
Right.
What was your takeaway? You know,
listen, I've seen a lot of Whoopi Goldberg over the years, and you know, I never looked at her as one of the haters and one of the those that you would consider an anti-Semite. There are many in Hollywood that are, and it's very clear that they are. I watched what her statement was, and I watched her again on another show explaining her statement. And I can definitely, I'm condemning it. I don't want to get fired and I'm not getting, you know, 2 weeks on probation here. If there is, I'm sure there's other things I probably deserve that for, but when it comes to, but when it comes to what she said, I definitely hear that there's confusion out there in terms of what is the difference between race and ethnicity. You know, if you look up the definitions, race clearly, and most definitions I looked up today online, we're always talking about features and the way you look and color of skin, where this ethnicity is a culture. So it's, again, I get it, Hitler, Yimach Shemo was about race. Judaism was, you know.
Well, I would separate out. Hold on. I would separate out because, you know, there's the question, which is legitimate to debate. What are the Jewish people? Are we a people? Are we a nation? Are we a
race? Or are we a race?
There's a discussion to have about that, right?
We're because all enough. Right.
You have Black Jews and white Jews, and you have Hispanic Jews and Latin Jews, and you have every type of Jew. So what are we? What does it mean to be a Jew? It's a fascinating conversation. One can have that debate, but that's entirely different than trying to. She said both on her show and then when she appeared on Stephen Colbert, where I thought she just doubled down on her mistake.
Right.
She referred to the Holocaust as white on white.
Right.
White people fighting with white people. By the way, as if the Jews were fighting back with the Nazis. Right? Her language was just atrocious, insensitive, offensive, ignorant. And to double down and to say, you know what? Yeah, I was thinking in the classic race definition of color of your skin, but you're right. Now that I've been educated, you're right that Hitler and the Nazis and the Final Solution was all about the Aryan race eradicating and exterminating the inferior race, the Jewish people. That was Hitler's own language. That was Hitler's own motive.
Correct.
That was Hitler's own. So, you know, maybe when you first made the mistake, you get a pass that you were thinking about it differently. But when you apologize, what you got to say is, I was insensitive and offensive. I was ignorant. You're right.
I've come to learn
how Hitler used the term and how the Jewish people feel about the term.
Right.
And I was wrong. And 100% you're correct. Instead, she tried to talk about, well, the Ku Klux Klan walked down the street. Right. I have to run because the color of my skin, but they'd walk right by the Jew. So I want to tell you a story. We were on vacation last week in Northern Florida, and we were in a town that doesn't have a lot of Jews. And a woman walked by my family and yelled, "Hey, you ugly Jews." I wrote about it in our weekly last week, and it was on Asian elsewhere, about that experience and about being a victim of a hate crime, of anti-Semitism. You know, thank God we weren't traumatized too terribly. But in fact, my kids very quickly pivoted to say, "You going to use this in a drusha or an article?" My kids very quickly used it to make fun of me. But I said the same thing,
just for the record, as soon as you told me that.
Yeah, and of course, it came out in an article right away. But my point is, this is why she's wrong. Now, maybe we're recognizable because of my yarmulke, because of the beard, because of my daughter's mode of dress. I don't know why, but she's wrong that the Ku Klux Klan would walk right by. They wouldn't walk right by me.
Right.
That woman didn't walk right by me in St. Augustine. She yelled an anti-Semitic slur. So it was ignorant. She doubled down on ignorance. Well, the real question is, so ABC suspended her, cancel culture, hard at work. On the one hand, a piece of me applauds that the Jew and anti-Semitism should just as much be protected by cancel culture. But on the other hand, what does it really do? Right? Maybe it would have been better to say that she's not been suspended, but Whoopi Goldberg will be touring the Holocaust Museum, will be sitting and talking to a group of survivors, will be coming to understand. We'll be taking a trip to Poland when Corona allows. She's going to educate herself on this issue because that's really our goal. And I want to bring our guest on momentarily. We've already gone deep into the program. But remember when Malcolm Honlein, we went behind the Bima with Malcolm Honlein?
Yep.
And by the way, we've had the who's who. What episode is this? Number 70, whatever. This is the greatest scholar in residence program on the planet.
Right.
And it hasn't cost one penny. We don't pay our guests one penny. We've had the who's who, the greatest. We've had athletes and we've had rabbis and we've had prominent business people and we've had NFL owners and we've had judges and we've had, anyway, when we had Malcolm Honlein behind the Bima, you remember he cautioned us not to label everything anti-Semitism. Be very careful who you label anti-Semitic and what you label anti-Semitism. And this is probably a great example of that. You're right. Whoopi Goldberg is probably not an anti-Semite. I don't think she's anti-Semitic. I just think she's ignorant. I think she's a fool. I think she's speaking. Again, why? Because
Jewish, by the way? Is she Jewish? Yeah,
I saw someone pointed that out. She kept describing herself as not being, but apparently she was born Karen Elaine Johnson, changed her name to Whoopi Goldberg, and in a bio somewhere online, someone wrote that she identifies as a non-practicing Jew. So I don't know. But, you know, my point is, you know, I don't know, cancel culture, suspend, don't suspend, but better to educate. How about win her over? Wouldn't it be great if she came back on The View and said, you know, I've taken the time, I've studied this, I understand where I was wrong, and I want to share with others why this is really important for us to not be out of line. So,
you know, can I just tell you that I think the most surprising thing was, if you watched the show, I kept looking at the reaction of the other three or four people on the same panel. And at no point did they jump in. You saw that, like, they were confused. They're like, is this something wrong? Is there something being said right now that shouldn't be said? But there was no one that just jumped at her and said, one second. Right. What'd you just say? That's
correct. Know, just correct.
Kind of strange.
Yeah, bizarre, right. Bizarre. In any case, we have an amazing guest on tonight, Myron Sugarman. We know him well. He's been coming to our community for a long time because he has a son who is a prominent rabbi in our community and one of the biggest Talmidei Chachamim and a great teacher of Torah and a dear, dear friend. He was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1938, he followed his father's footsteps into the family business, and he ran with a certain segment of society that we wouldn't necessarily, or I shouldn't say necessarily, we would never condone or endorse or support. When you talk about the mafia, the mob, the Jewish mafia or mob, certainly is not part of our value system and what we believe. But the purpose of this interview is not to really investigate that part of the Jewish mafia and mob, but is to understand some sides of that world that we may never have never heard of. He is the author of a memoir called The Last Jewish Gangster, From Meyer to Myron. And he has been speaking all over the world, and a new documentary is coming out about him. And right. He's a fascinating, fascinating personality. So there's a lot of parts of the Jewish mafia or mob that you may not be aware of. And, you know, Pop is usually off the hook, hilarious, entertaining. Tonight's conversation, I think, is a little more serious as we talk about some of these issues today of anti-Semitism and when the Jewish mafia stood up to the American Nazis and helped found the State of Israel and other examples like that. So we're excited to be able to bring him on and hope that you enjoy this interview. We have a privilege of being joined today by the one and only, the great Myron Sugarman, known affectionately to us as Pop Sugarman. We have the privilege of knowing Pop for many, many years, really part of our BRS family, our community family. Pop has children who are distinguished leaders in our community. And we've been listening and learning from Pop for many, many years. So, Mr. Sugarman, Myron, Pop, thanks so much for being with us and letting us go behind the bima with you.
Okay, Rabbi. Let's get the show on the road.
So, Pop, you've led an incredibly fascinating life. Your childhood, some of the people and personalities and characters you were exposed to. You are a living legend. Your knowledge of the history of the Jews of Newark and of that time, Jewish participation in some areas of life, the mafia, the mob, and elsewhere, the founding of the State of Israel, fighting anti-Semitism. We really want to go behind the bima with you about your life and the lessons we can glean today. We've seen this rise of anti-Semitism in our time. We've seen hostility towards Israel. What are some of the lessons that we can get? So let's start with your life. Tell us about your childhood. Tell us about some of the people and personalities that you were exposed to, that you learned from, and some of the things that you saw that could lend some lessons for today.
Well, that's a whole lot of subject there. But let's start like this. My father, may rest in peace, Shuggy, hell of a guy. They don't make him like that. That world, I'm not even a percentage of what that world was. However, of all of that world, they were tough Jews, no identity crisis, proud, proof to the Italians and to the others that they're just as tough as they are and so forth. And they were patriots. They were both American patriots, believe it or not, and they were certainly Jewish patriots. The problem lied in the fact that, for example, with you mentioned in your community, well, my son is a rabbi. And how did he become a rabbi? Is because I understood, as I thought more about Jewish pride, that we're not going to have posterity without Judaism. There can be no Jews without Judaism. And so as a result of that, I made it my business within my crazy or unique world of living as an outlaw, operating a business, an unlicensed illegal gambling machine business throughout the entire world, but particularly in New York and New Jersey, that it was most important that we identify with Orthodox Judaism. And as a result, I sent Benny, who's a rabbi in your world, in your community, to a yeshiva. Amongst the surprise of all of my contemporaries. And so my own personal view is a tough Jew, not just the physical, the mental, the proud part, and the knowledge, because the pride comes from as a result of knowledge. So as a kid growing up, my father was...
Where did you grow up? Where did you grow up? What neighborhood did you grow up in?
Newark and suburbs, Mayport, New Jersey. Pop was roaring 20s, combination of roaring 20s, and his parents, which of course were immigrants, strictly Orthodox, strictly Shomer Shabbos, Grandma Sugarman. She wouldn't even drink a glass of ice water in a kosher restaurant. She used to bring her own food. She'd carry a banana with a piece of bread, buttered bread she'd eat. And when we'd go out, I used to take her to give tzedakah to all the old timers. So, and Pop was roaring 20s. He was prohibition, promotion of boxing, gambling machines, jukeboxes. And he was part of the Meyer Lansky, Longy's Willman world, which of course were the leadership of the Jewish mob. And of course we all had the Hebrew school education and the bar mitzvah, the party and so forth. And then after that, I used to go for boxing lessons on Saturday mornings. I had to quit at the age of 12 in order to get ready for the bar mitzvah. But otherwise, once we were bar mitzvahed, we really, I say that the only connection we had was on Saturday nights when we used to go to the different temple dances throughout each town of northern New Jersey.
Were you a good boxer? Did you have good skills in boxing?
The object of it, of course, was to learn self-defense. They used to put us on as kids before the Golden Glove fights or the PLL, the Police Athletic League fights and so forth. So it was just in a college, I didn't do so good, but I, you know, the object is to be able to defend yourself, not to be able to get into a ring. In our time, boxing was a sport that if you went to a Jewish camp, summer camp, boxing was part of the curriculum. Automatically, everybody took boxing lessons. But on Saturday mornings as a kid, I used to go down to the Newark Athletic Club and take boxing lessons from an old professional Jewish prize fighter. It was my father's idea to make sure that I was prepared to put up my dukes and defend myself.
So you grew up, your father was part of that crew, of that crowd. Did you know Meyer Lansky personally?
The crew, he was a proud Jew involved with the United Jewish Appeal at the time of the creation of the State of Israel. He was the chairman of the, and each industry had a support group for the United Jewish Appeal at that time to help create the State of Israel. Of course, my father was together with Longy and Meyer Lansky. He goes all the way back in time to the subject of the Minutemen, the Jews that fought the American Nazi Party in various cities throughout the entire United States. But Newark, New Jersey, where my father was born and came from, was a battleground with the American Nazi Party. And Abner Longy's Willman, a name which not too many people know about if you didn't come from New Jersey, was the leader of, on an equal level with Meyer Lansky, of the Jewish mob in the United States of America. fought the American Nazi Party, Newark, New Jersey, in New York, in Chicago, in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Chicago, Los Angeles, and so forth. Wherever you had the rise of anti-Semitism, the mob took on the responsibility of fighting with the American Nazi Party or with other anti-Semitic groups like the Silver Shirts. That was headed up by William Dudley Pelley, which was a very powerful anti-Semitic organization, white supremacists and all the rest.
So, there's a stereotype. They have a stereotype, Pop, that Jews are weak and meek and passive and they can't defend themselves. And you're saying that this group broke that stereotype. Where do you think they got the courage? Where did they get the gall to stand up to this Nazi party and to fight anti-Semitism in a time that it wasn't just the American Nazi Party? America and Americans weren't necessarily so favorable to the Jews then. So how did they break that stereotype? Where did they get the spine, the backbone?
Coming from the ghetto. Remember, right, at the time of the turn of the 20th century, we started to, boxing, prize fighting was the major sport of the Jews in the United States. We had thousands of professional Jewish prize fighters. We had one third of the champions of the world were Jews, and wore Mug and Dovet on their pants, on their boxing shorts, and proudly identified as Jews to show that we're not, after 2,000 years, we're not going to lower our heads. You know, this was Jabotinsky revisionist Zionist mentality. Although if you would have asked my father who Jabotinsky was, he had no idea. The only thought that came to mind as far as the Jews were concerned at the United States was to show that we will not tolerate physical attacks on Jews. And so different organizations, different mobs would organize for the purpose of combating with these anti-Semitic organizations. In Newark, New Jersey, there was a prize fighter by the name of Abramowitz. He fought under the name of Nat Arno. And he went along, Abner Longy's woman, who was the mob boss and all over Jersey. I mean, he was known as the Al Capone of New Jersey. And asked his usage of his political connections and formed an organization. Nat Arno formed an organization called the Minutemen, in honor of the Minutemen of the American Revolutionary War, that in a minute's notice they would go fight the British. Well, our guys went and fought the Nazis. Newark, New Jersey was a serious battleground. We had a large German population in Newark and in the surrounding areas. And Fritz Kuhn, who declared himself as the Hitler of the United States, Yimach Shemo, he started in Newark, New Jersey, and in the surrounding New Jersey suburbs, forming the American Nazi Party, which culminated in 1939 at Madison Square Garden. They had 25,000 supporters of the American Nazi Party that met in Madison Square Garden, and we had a gigantic protest against it. But this was not only here in the United States, this also was in London. There was a Jewish gangster there by the name of Jack Comer. They called him Jack Spot. And the Jews fought the black shirts of the British United Fascist Party in 1936. You'll find it on YouTube. It's called the Battle of Cable Street. So the Jews were people the social economics was not Boca Raton, Florida, nor was it Palm Beach, Florida, nor Short Hills, New Jersey, nor Livingston, New Jersey. This were people, these were kids that came out of the ghetto. And so they were physically tough because they had to be tough. You fought with each other and you had to be ready to fight with the with Polish, Italian, Irish, or what other German, what other anti-Semites would come into the ghetto in order to abuse or to rob or to steal or to beat up Jews. So Longhi, by the way, Abner Longhi, his woman got his name Longhi because the old Jews, when the Shkutzim would come from other neighborhoods to beat up Jews, they would holler Rift for the Langer, call the tall one Langer. Langer became Longhi, and that's how he got the name Longhi. He was the leader of the mob of the Jewish kids, of the gangsters, the mobsters, and so forth, that ultimately waxed very wealthy during the period of the Prohibition. When Prohibition ended, the Roaring Twenties ended, that's when we had the rise of anti-Semitism in the United States of America, much like what we're having today throughout the entire United States of America. And we started to talk before the show started about watching that brutal event in Orlando, Florida. It's brutal. It's hard to watch. And of course, some Rabbi Kahan from Israel sent me an email this morning. Get the Minutemen. Have to go to the cemetery to get those guys. That's a problem. It's a major problem now. So the question is, how do you fight anti-Semitism? One thing is for sure: you're never gonna get rid of it. You're never gonna cure it. It's gonna be there from it started 3,333 years ago, and even before that, and it's gonna be here for till the last hour of eternity. It's a baseless hatred. There's no explanation to it, and that's all there is to be said about it. We just have to figure out how to deal with it, right?
So what can we learn about your childhood and some of those personalities? About how to deal with it? What can we learn from some of those personalities of your childhood? You talked about the Minutemen. Do we grow a spine, a backbone? Do we stand up to it? And do we confront and make demands? Are we proud? Do we cower, apologize, just blend in and try to essentially avoid attracting attention? What's the response?
Rabbi, good question. We don't have Minutemen anymore, all right? Not physical Minutemen, all right? But we need mental Minutemen. You need them mentally, emotionally, psychologically, the same as you had physical, mental, psychological, emotional, absent the physical. We don't have that. Our kids did not grow up tough. They didn't go to learn how to prize fight. Their fathers didn't send them to the Newark Athletic Club on Saturday morning to learn how to box. Our kids are on computers. They're learning how to be good Jews, learning how to do mitzvot. They're learning how to do wonderful things. But there's got to be a part of that education which teaches them Jewish pride, so that, yes, we need to stand up to them. So if there was an organization in the United States that anytime there was an act of anti-Semitism, there'd be a massive response to it. One Jew being molested is every Jew being molested, whether it's in Jersey City, whether it's in Crown Heights, whether it's in Williamsburg, whether it's Muncie, or whether it's in Orlando, Florida. There has to be a gigantic response to it. We haven't heard one word from Washington, D.C. I haven't seen anything I've been watching the news specifically waiting to see if there's any kind of a response from Washington. I see a great response from your governor, good guy, but I don't see anything coming from Washington, D.C. There has to be that kind of pressure on Washington. Of course, we don't have somebody that's particularly pro-Jewish sitting in the White House right now, But that doesn't mean that we should refrain from putting pressure on them, gigantic pressure, with all of our strength, with all of our political connections, our influence. We need to be concentrating on this right now. Kids going to college, it's the craziest thing on the face of the earth. Parents are paying $250,000 minimum to send the kids to college so that the kids are intimidated by the anti-Semites on campus. There has to be a response to that. And it's got to be a powerful response, not something lukewarm.
Do you think the reason we're not responding
that's
is
the only answer?
Do you think the reason we're not responding is because we're afraid or because we're weaker, we're softer?
I think we're too interested in our own money. I think that we're interested too much in I'm hearing, oh, this guy sold his business. This guy's in the stock market. This guy doing some kind of a financial achievement and so forth. There's too much emphasis on that and not enough emphasis on the question of Jewish safety and security. I think that we're just really too focused today on, oh, this guy made a killing in the market. This one's got Bitcoin. This one's this and that one says that. Where there's not enough emphasis on the question of Jewish safety and security, we're compromising it out for something called materialism, for wealth, idolizing the wrong people.
Who's going to provide the security to fight this anti-Semitism? Are we relying on the government and legislation? Are we relying on security guards outside every shul, every synagogue campus? Or do Jews themselves need to train in self-defense? And do Jews themselves need to pay
without
make anti-Semites, make them pay a price
a
so that nobody else?
Without a doubt, there needs to be a Mayor Kahane mentality. Now, of course, everybody's like, oh, Mayor Kahane, terrible man, so forth and so forth. Horrible, this, that, and so forth. The guy was a hero. Instead of where we are condemning heroes, people that should be heroic in our eyes, we're making these people into demons. It's just a cockeyed way of looking at things.
Talk about, let's pivot for a minute. You met Meyer Lansky, you knew him?
Yeah. So Meyer Lansky, I met him in Israel in 1970. He specifically came looking for me. He heard that I was there. I used to, when I would go to Israel, I'd spend time with Doc Stacher. Doc Stacher was on the same level. Meyer Lansky, Longis Willman, Benny Siegel, and Doc Stacher. Doc Stacher accepted deportation from the United States and made a deal with Robert Kennedy in 1963 to accept exile from the United States in lieu of a income tax case. Doc Stacher was my father's dear, dear friend going all the way back to childhood, and he was his partner with my father and Abe Green in jukeboxes and gaming devices and so forth. And so Doc, when I would go to Israel, I'd spent my time with Doc. And so many of the stories that I know from the mob were the stories that were told to me by all of my father's friends. Endless stories. And so Doc one day told me, be at the old Sheraton Hotel for lunch on Shabbos. Friend of his wanted to meet me, and sure enough, it was Meyer Lansky came. Meyer Lansky was concerned at that time with another one of my father's partners, who was boss of the Genovese crime family. His name was Gerard Katina. And Mr. Katina was incarcerated at that time for refusal to testify to grand jury after being granted immunity. He was locked up and did something almost like 5.5-6 years in prison for contempt of for contempt of court, for refusal to testify to grand jury. Anyways, Meyer Lansky was concerned because Jerry Katina was now in charge of the rake-off coming out of Vegas, and both Meyer Lansky and Doc Statue wanted to know what his status was, because Mr. Katina was responsible for their particular end of the rake-off coming out of the casinos in Vegas. We had a long conversation. You know, my father. My father was one of the investors going back at the time of 1959, right? Sold out his shares in the Riviera Hotel in Cuba right before the revolution when Castro came to power. So, Meyer Lansky, every Jew in the United States that was connected, of course, Meyer Lansky knew, they knew Meyer, and Meyer they knew them. And we had a very cordial conversation in which he told me that the United States government had made him bigger than Al Capone, because that was at the time of Nixon and Mitchell government, and they wanted to take some of the heat off themselves, so they made a big deal out of Meyer Lansky. That's why Meyer Lansky took off for Israel. Of course, the Israeli government ultimately capitulated under the pressure from the Nixon government, and although they didn't send Meyer Lansky directly back to the United States, they canceled his visa to remain in Israel. Meyer Lansky tried to get into Argentina. Our State Department at that time sent a message to the State Department, to the government of Argentina. Don't let that Jew off the airplane. Send him back to Florida. And he came to Florida. He went to trial two times. And eventually, the government dropped its charges. He died of cancer at the age of 81. What kind of a guy he was? A very proud Jew, 100% patriotic. When he fought the American Nazi Party in Yorkville, Lucky Luciano said to him, Meyer, I'll give you all the guys that you need in order to beat up those Nazis. All right? And Meyer Lansky says to Charlie Lucky Luciano, he says, thank you, Charlie. He says, thank. But, however, I'm appreciative, but this is a Jewish problem. It's going to be resolved with Jewish fists. So he went up to Yorkville with a group of guys, and they did an effective job beating the crap out of the Nazis. The same as what our guys were doing in Newark, New Jersey. There's a very, very good book written by a friend of mine called The Nazis in Newark by Warren Grover. I wish I could take my passion and give it to every Jew on the face of the earth. I live for this, Rabbi. And with this passion, it's the most, I live it 24 hours, day and night. And I wish I could convey that to every Jew, that this is the most important thing on the face of the earth, is your Jewish pride. And by the way, you strengthen your Jewish pride by knowledge of Judaism. And I continue to say that, you know, there can no be in the future, can never be in the future, no posterity of Jews without Judaism. You can't, and that was the problem with Pop's generation, is that it was a one generation source of pride. The children today, unfortunately, without reinforcement of knowledge of Jewish education, unfortunately, the kids are 70% married outside of the Jewish religion. So that Jewish pride that we talked about needs to be reinforced with both knowledge and with passion.
Mr. Sugarman,
they got to know their Zionist history. We got to know about Jabotinsky. We got to know about Menachem Begin. You got to know about Yair Stern. You got to know about names like Eliyahu Hachim or Eliyahu Batsuri, the boys, Yitzhak Shamir, the two boys that Shamir sent to Cairo to assassinate Lord Moyne. We need to know about Barzani. We got to know about Feinstein. Names that Kovner, people that don't know, we know, got to give those kids the knowledge about our struggle to create the state of Israel that wasn't created with mitzvot. Go do mitzvot, but at the same time, we got to teach our kids Jewish pride, self-defense. Should be part of the curriculum of every yeshiva on the face of the earth, teaching our kids self-defense, not to be scared. When you asked the question of boxing, was I any good? It was good enough as a kid. I was a good scrapper, but the most important thing was not to be afraid to take a punch, not run away.
Wow.
I think that's...
What did the rabbis or the community leaders say about what was taking place? Did they say to you, behind closed doors, we're happy to see that this is being taken care of? Did they try to discourage you from doing it? What was taking place among the leaders?
At the time my father's time of the Minutemen. So everybody was proud. Yeah. Everybody shared the pride of it. But the reform movement was against it. They publicly denounced it. These are Jewish ruffians and so forth. This is not the way Jews behave themselves. I can't understand politically that kind of mentality. We didn't create the state of Israel with the mentality of Rabbi Stephen Wise. You created the state of Israel with the mentality of Rabbi Cook. Our mentality of the Jews in the time of World War II was pitiful. There was no protest. The only ones that we had was Ben Hecht and Peter Bergson. And if I mention those names, people say, who the hell are you talking about? And they were the outspoken members of the only outspoken voices for the protest against the Holocaust, which everybody knew about. Not a word was said. They loved Roosevelt. I've got a passion. I wish everybody had my knowledge and my passion. If I could put that in every human, in every Jew's mind, heart, I'd be the happy. I would say that my life was a success. But
Pop, let me ask you
what I'm thinking. What I'm
let me ask you another question, Pop. So, Behind the Bima, of course, does not condone the mafia, mob, or mob personalities or illegal activity. Let's just be very clear. Behind the Bima does not condone or support that. But people may not be aware that the mob or the Jewish mafia was not only involved in fighting the American Nazi Party, they were also instrumental in the founding of the State of Israel in terms of smuggling weapons. Could you speak a little bit about the story of getting weapons to the founders of the State of Israel?
Let's talk first about the mafia, or about the Jewish mob, all right? The Jewish mob was a response to crazy governmental laws. No, I'm not going to condone it either. The early Jewish mob were involved in drugs and involved in prostitution and things and activities which are the most lowest form of human behavior. No ands, ifs, and buts. That's another discussion for another time. Yes, on the question of the help, supply, and weapons and arms for the State of Israel, there's a book called The Pledge. It was written in 1970. I can't think of the name of the author right now at this particular time. However, the Jewish mob played a very significant role in supply of weapons and arms, and particularly in the shipping of illegal weapons and arms. Remember, at the time of 1948, Truman was the president. Yes, he recognized the State of Israel. However, he invoked the Neutrality Act of 1939, which stated that supply of weapons and arms to Palestine, either to Jews or to Arabs, was a criminal activity. And so, in order to be able to create the State of Israel, the Zionists depended upon the supply of weapons and arms provided by both legitimate Jewish businessmen and the mob. Now, in the question of shipping of weapons and arms, of course, the port of Newark, Hoboken, New York, Bayonne, and so forth was controlled by the longshoremen. The longshoremen was controlled by the mob. After the exile of Lucky Luciano to Sicily, the longshoremen came under the leadership of Frank Costello and Albert Anastasia. The Zionists went to Meyer Lansky and to Longy's woman and asked them for their connection, their help and support to go to Anastasia, to Albert Anastasia and to Frank Costello for the longshoremen to cooperate with the Zionists in the shipping of illegal weaponry to Palestine. All of that was done with the full cooperation of the longshoremen, because all your weaponry was declared under, of course, fake manifest, those are ladings stating agricultural equipment, fertilizer, and so forth, where they were shipping dynamite and all forms of weapons that were gathered up and brought to the port of New York, and our guys, together with the longshoremen, packed up and shipped this contraband to Palestine. The Altalena, by the way, the very famous event, the very famous episode of the Altalena was supposedly originated with money that was gathered up by Mickey Cohen, the famous gangster from Los Angeles, who ran a fundraising event at a place called Slappy Maxie's Comedy Club on Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. And that money was used to buy up weaponry to ship on the ship called the Altalena, which was an Irgun operation. And the rest is all history. The Altalena, a lot of people know about it. A lot of people don't know about it, but it was almost the cause for civil war had not Menachem Begin ordered ceasefire.
What was your pop? You had a relationship with Simon Wiesenthal, and he enlisted your help also?
I volunteered my services as a kid. I was in Vienna, Austria. My wife was a Jewish girl, Benny's mother's. My wife is from Argentina. And so I was very impressed with the capture of Eichmann in Argentina. One second, I could just take a drink for a second. And I was in Vienna the first time doing business. And I sought out Simon Wiesenthal. I went to his office and introduced myself. And I became very, very close with him. Over the years, raised a tremendous amount of money. I felt that the pursuit of Nazi war criminals would, while I wasn't going to be a Minuteman because there were no more Minutemen, I felt that my responsibility as a Jew was to help in some form track down Nazi war criminals. And so I offered my services, and Simon Wiesenthal and I became, that was my mentor, and I became his disciple. So when I would travel all over South America doing business, he would give me messages to deliver to certain people, to pursue certain knowledge, see certain people. He was known as Rabbi Akiva in South America. That's the name everybody referred to him as. And in Paraguay, I tell the story that I was sent to see a fellow by name, gentleman by the name of Louis Schumstein. And he did tell me that there was a sighting at that time of Joseph Mengele. Honestly, I try to remember more or less when it was, sometime in the early 1980s, middle 80s maybe, that this story took place. And he told me that there had been a sighting. But also at the same time, in Asuncion, Paraguay, he told me, meet me at a cafe outside of Asuncion. I took a taxi. I went to see him. He said, please, stay out of Asuncion, Paraguay, asking questions about Nazi war criminals, particularly Mengele. He says, this is not a very healthy environment for a Jew to go around asking questions about Nazi war criminals. The dictator of Paraguay was a grandson of Germans by the name of Alfredo Stroessner. And he was responsible for protecting endless numbers of Nazis that sought refuge in Paraguay. And he told me, you're putting yourself at jeopardy, and you're putting the Jews of Asuncion, Paraguay. We're a small community. Most of us are survivors of the Holocaust, of the concentration camps. Okay, so, and then the same evening, or the same afternoon, when I was getting ready to go out, meet for being taken out by business associates. He was waiting for me in the lobby. And he told me he was overwhelmed with an American boy that had no connection whatsoever with Shoah. And that there was, and he was going to give me the name and more people to go see and so forth. He never showed up again. He swore to me that he would go to see Wiesenthal, bring him information. About a few months later, I was on an airplane going from Asuncion, Paraguay to Buenos Aires. There was a couple sitting next to me, old-timers, and they were speaking in Yiddish. And I tell them I'm a Jewish guy from America. And I understand American Yiddish, Yankee Yiddish. My level was not on their level. But anyways, they were nice and started to chat and who do you know, and play Jewish geography. And when I mentioned I know Louis Schumstein, they asked me, are you the American boy that was here a couple of months ago talking to Schumstein? And I says, yeah. The woman tells me a story. They own a dry goods store in the central part of Asuncion, Paraguay. I don't remember these people's names, but she told me the story that one day she's there all by herself, and then walks Joseph Mengele. She was a survivor of Auschwitz, recognizes Mengele. He realizes, she freezes, and he realizes that he was identified immediately. Jumped in his, with his two bodyguards, made a U-turn, jumped in his vehicle, took off. Of course, the information was sent to Wiesenthal, but supposedly, not supposedly, it was confirmed that Mengele died on a swimming, drowned off of the shores of Pernambuco on the northeastern part of Brazil. That was the extent of, I had a long history and relationship with Simon Wiesenthal. I was the guy that he would call when he came to New York. And of course, the image of Wiesenthal is that he was a nominee for the Nobel Prize. But truth be known, Wiesenthal was a Beitarnik. He was a follower of Jabotinsky, and if it was up to him, between you and me and Rabbi Brody, he would have preferred that every one of those mamzerim would have been shot dead. So that's the Wiesenthal story. And I can tell you one more fascinating story about Wiesenthal as evidence of, as proof of what, how I just described Wiesenthal's attitude as far as Nazis are concerned. But I'll leave it. So any other questions, Rabbi?
Yeah, I just got a question. You know, you mentioned before how it was so important to you to send your kids to Orthodox schools and go to yeshivas. I'm wondering, when they came home from school, did you ever hear, you know, they said, you know, our friends are talking about what our father does. They're saying, you know, our friends don't want to come over. The parents don't want to let them come to our house because they're a little concerned. Was that ever a concern?
I think we might have some. Oh, is it back?
I lost him.
We're having a problem with the problem.
Hold on, Pop. Can you hear us? We got you back. Pop. Oh, we've temporarily lost Pop Sugarman. I'll be back in one moment.
You know what I'm saying? Like they have, you know, bring your father to school day. You're like, what do you say your dad does?
Yeah, Pop was in a different line of work. We didn't really get into that specifics about his participation in that line of work, although people can read more in his book, in his personal memoir, right, about his connection. Oh, here we go. Let's see. He's coming back.
Oh, well, okay.
There we go. Okay. We're back.
What was your question, Rabbi?
Okay. Yeah, just wondering, you know, so some
what
something.
What was the question?
Yeah, the question was when let's say Benny was in school and they said, you know, hey, I'm just wondering, like, my dad's an accountant, my dad's a lawyer, like, what would he say? How much do you keep the family in or out of what it is that you might be associated with?
when Benny was 15 years of age, in order to train for the rabbinate, he used to come down to the warehouse. And he learned how to fix the slot machine so that they wouldn't pay out on the jackpot. And that's how he learned how to become a rabbi.
Did his friend's parents, did they say, listen, we don't want our kids going over the home because maybe there's a little bit of a concern? And how did you deal
with
that?
One family made it very, very clear that he didn't want his kid to, and it is one of the most famous of all the Jewish families in America, didn't want his kid coming to my house because I would end up making him into a proud Jew. But he said, no, I would corrupt him. But the fact of the matter is that people love Jewish gangsters. They love this particular Jewish gangster. I got no problem going anywhere and for people and getting along with people. I love people and people love me. There's no problem.
Pop, there's a documentary about your life.
I make it very clear. Huh?
You want to share about the documentary about your life? You want to tell everybody about the documentary about your life and where they can watch it?
The documentary is finished, but the producers are talking to studios, so they're not ready to release it yet. And if they do sell it, they're going to sell it to some major studio. They're going to make a movie about me, and I'm going to become an octogenarian rock star, and I'm going to need mob control. All right.
The protection.
I'll be bodyguards. I'll be out in Hollywood hobnobbing with Bette Midler and with Barbara Streisand. Teaching them how to become proud Jews.
Well, Pop, thank you for your time. Thank you for enlightening us with these stories. And, you know, as we said, there's a lot obviously about the mob and mafia we do not condone or identify with, but there are aspects of they're confronting anti-Semitism, helping get arms to the state of Israel, hunting Nazis with Simon Wiesenthal. These are some of the sides of the Jewish mob that most people are not familiar with. Anything else that people don't know? Anything else people don't know about the Jewish mob they should?
Yes. You know that the mob, both the Jewish and the Italian mob, cooperated with the United States Department of Navy in what was known as Operation Underworld in World War II, protecting against sabotage and espionage against the infiltration of Nazi spies and saboteurs. It's another piece of history. It's called, there's a book called Operation Underworld that was written by somebody by the name of Campbell. So nothing in this world is either black or white. It's so many different shades of gray that makes up the human experience. So, again, you're 100% right. Let's not glorify or make these people into perfect, perfect heroes or perfect non-heroes, into perfect role models. But certainly, there's so much to derive from every aspect of the human experience. And we have to look for that. That's all part of the wisdom.
Absolutely. Any closing thoughts you have for us?
What is King David?
Yeah. Any closing thoughts?
I'm going to give you words of wisdom. All right. And I want this to let's say, for example, I always tell everybody, all right, when they come to me and they tell me that they want to kill this guy. So I tell them like this. If you have to use muscle at the end, it's because you didn't use brain in the beginning. All right. If you made a mistake, all right, it's you made the mistake. You misjudged the human being. You ascribed qualities to that person that person never had. All right. And over the years, I developed that thought, and I'm sure it's not the original thought, but it's one that I concluded on my own, that you have to, in everything as far as life is concerned, think before you act. Do as much homework as you possibly can. Vet every situation, every human being. All right. Wisdom is the ultimate objective of the life of every human being.
Very well said. Very well said. Rabbi Brody, you have a closing question?
I had an old gangster from Paterson, New Jersey, who was my guy in the street. His name was, they called him Louis Red. They also called him Louis Streaky, but he told me, he says, I prefer the name Louis Red. And he used to say like this, everything but principle leaves this earth. So what do you mean, everything but principle? The only thing that you leave behind is the wisdom that you share with others. That's principle. People aren't going to remember anything else about you other than the fact that wisdom that you shared with the next generation. And that's going from generation to generation to generation. He had a great statement. Every time I used to see him, he used to remind me of his thought. He says, everything but principle leaves this earth. All right?
Hmm. Wow.
Listen, well, I had a good time with you guys this morning.
So got one quick question. This is coming in. Our listeners want to know. They're saying, where is Jimmy Hoffa buried? They say, if anyone knows, it's probably, you know, you might have some idea. Maybe. Not sure why. We're going to end the show.
They want to know where Jimmy Hoffa is. Why? They want to go there and put a stone on his grave?
Maybe. They got to make a cottage or something.
And they think that I know the answer. And if I knew the answer, you think I'm going to tell them what the answer is? All right.
There you go.
There you go.
There you go.
Just wink once for Giant Stadium.
Huh?
No. We're good.
All right, Pop, thank you for your time. Thank you for your wisdom. We really appreciate it. A piece of history that most are not familiar with. And we'll look forward to your next visit to Boca to continue to catch up and hear more of your wisdom.
Rabbi.
Yeah.
When I do an Aliyah in my Chabad in West Orange, New Jersey, they stand up and applaud. I didn't get that kind of response last time I was in Boca. Huh?
We're gonna have to train them better.
All the best, rabbis. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you. Took your life into your hands with that question, Brody. Rabbi Brody. Way to contribute to Behind the Bima, let me tell you. Oh, yeah, Mr. Rabbi Moskowitz. Mr. Rabbi Moskowitz. We hope he'll be back soon. Please guide him.
In the meantime, everyone should
respect his privacy.
Wow.
So that was Myron Sugarman, Pop Sugarman. Read his book, The Last Jewish Gangsta. And, you know, not for the show, because we do not condone or support mafia or mob activity. But he's the real deal. And there's a lot in his life that is evidence that he was the real deal, part of that world. He's a character, but he also has depth to him and knows a lot of history, and was a fascinating conversation. So I'm glad we had the opportunity to go behind the Bima with him.
I love his passion. He is so passionate. You know,
I'll tell you a great story. Do you know when I was introduced to Pop Sugarman and his colorful background? When Benny Daff, as we like to call him in the Jewish mafia, Benny Daff, when Rabbi Sugarman, huge Talmud Chacham, dear friend, turned 40. So we're talking a little more than a few years ago. So there was a big party at a restaurant with his friends. A bunch of guys went out with him, and his father, Pop, showed up. So Pop says, I'll tell you what, boys, we're going to go around, and if everyone says something nice about Benny, I'll cover dinner. So everybody goes around, and everybody says something nice. And it was a very diverse group of guys that were there. Very diverse group. However you define diversity, by age and by observance level and knowledge, every description of diversity was diverse. So everyone went around, and what many people pointed out was, you know, what makes Ben very special, really amazing, is he's beloved by so many. He doesn't just fit in one group or one crowd. Everyone who knows him, no matter where they are and what they're at in life, they all love him. So Pop gets up and he says, let me explain to you why Benny is so diverse. Because let me tell you about his childhood and the kind of people he grew up with. And then he goes up and starts talking about all these guys, Longy and Blue Eyes and Red and all these characters and guys, and starts telling stories and all about them and Ben's life and childhood. But it is amazing because Pop did not grow up observant.
Right.
And he was not building a family that was observant. And he decided out of nowhere that he was going to send his son to Jewish school. And he tells a story in his book about when he told his wife, we're sending him to Jewish school. And his wife said, over my dead body. For the punchline, I'll let you read the book to find the end of that story. But he ended up sending his son, and he's part of Orthodox community now, West Orange, and Ben's a huge Talmud Chacham, and has built a beautiful family. So it's interesting, given that colorful background and colorful personalities and the business his father was in that he inherited, it's really something fascinating. So check out the documentary and the book. We don't condone, we don't endorse, we don't support illegal activity or activity that's against halacha. But, you know, the Rambam, quoting Aristotle, says you could learn from wherever the truth comes, even if you don't take everything. But there's wisdom, there's truth, and you could take it, you could learn it. Closing thoughts, Rabbi Brody.
Yeah, it just makes you think, you know, are we weaker than we should be? Not weaker than maybe previous generations. You know, we've spoken about that, the heroes of the Holocaust and how they fought back, and would we have the strength to do that today? You know,
Yeah.
Like he referenced what are our kids doing? They're you know, we like to think they're all learning Torah. I hope that they are, but you know, when they're not, they're playing video games. They're not putting on boxing gloves.
Somebody sent me that they think that we need to do self-defense classes, that the Jew today needs to grow up with some self-defense classes. You need to know. I mean, look at what happened in Texas.
Right.
And you need some training. God forbid someone's holding you hostage. You need some training. What if somebody comes in, active shooter, right? We do those lockdown drills and we do that training. So does a Jew need training that what if you're walking down the street in St. Augustine? I got in trouble because I said the location, but that's not where we were staying. So I didn't give away our great vacation spot. We drove to go to St. Augustine, the oldest city in America.
What?
Oldest city in America.
Hmm.
By the way, do I look younger tonight? Because Fountain of Youth. Oldest city in America, St. Augustine. So you need training. What if that person didn't just yell a slur? What if they raised a fist? Now, I'd like to think that I take care of my family, but
right.
I don't know why I would think that.
Yeah, because in fifth grade, we took karate.
There's really nothing in my childhood or my own experience in life.
I'm a red belt.
Yeah.
Toward Joe Dojo, you know?
Most violent act that's happened to us is like somebody at the kiddush trying to talk to you, so they're spitting egg salad in your face while they're talking. Like, that's the most violence that we've faced. So I don't know. I'd like to think that I'd be ready to handle it, but would I? So do we need to have training? Should we be having self-defense classes? Do Jewish kids today need to grow up to know if you're walking down the streets of New York or St. Augustine or wherever, somebody raises a fist? I mean, once a week you see a video online of security camera caught of a Jew being beaten up on a street somewhere where someone's walking by, a helpless Jew, and out of nowhere they raise a fist. And do we need to have self-defense?
Right. Before this year, you never heard of it. It was unheard of. And now it's
you'd never imagine it. No, there were always those people who'd raise that and you'd be like, come on.
Right.
What's the likelihood? What's the incidence? What are the data? Come on.
We used to have, remember back in the day, we used to have a karate class once a week.
Yes.
In the shul.
There's a member of our shul who was driving elsewhere in Northern Florida. And he was driving in his truck. Must have had a yarmulke on, not his baseball cap. And there were a group of like skinheads who yelled at him and said, Hitler and the Nazis should have finished you off. So like I would have driven away as fast as possible. This tough Jew, he pulls up to the group, lowers his window, and he says, you know what the difference was between the Jews of Germany and now? So they looked at him kind of puzzled. And he said, the Second Amendment. In other words, what he was packing in his pocket and in his car. Now, should Jews own guns? This is not the time. Behind the Bima does not weigh in on gun control, gun laws, and those issues. But I don't know. In my whole life, I never thought so. But you hear about a rabbi being held hostage in the shul. What if there were a gun under the safe of my desk, which people have encouraged me to have, and I was trained? You can't have it and not be trained.
Right.
It has to be legal, and you have training. So do kids today need training in self-defense? Should rabbis know how to use a gun? These are questions we never had to ask before. We never dreamt we'd have to ask here.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering if people are even asking the questions, or we just like to think, like, just don't worry about it. Let's hope that you won't need it, you know? And it's
a passing fad. It's a phase. Right. It's corona irritation. Question. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what's coming. I'll tell you again, the people who are like, we're on our way back to Nazi Germany, 1930. Right. No, we're not. You know, right now you have, and I would disagree with Shuggy on this. You do have a White House. You have a White House, a Senate, a House. You have governors and mayors who all speak out against anti-Semitism. They speak out, they legislate. It's just not true. The elected officials in America are fantastic. By the way, our soon guest, we went behind the Bima with Richie Torres, Congressman Richie Torres. He was fantastic on Twitter this week. Spoke about the Whoopi Goldberg issue. We spoke about racism and the Holocaust. And he's spoken out against anti-Semitism. I can't wait that we're hosting him live in Bloomington Synagogue in a couple of weeks because he's wonderful.
And Riverdale's about to get him.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So there is that fundamental difference that our elected officials, I think, are excellent. They're outspoken. That doesn't mean we can rest. It doesn't mean we can relax.
But you saw that video that came out of Orlando this week?
Yeah.
Where people were saying maybe that was Boca. I mean, I don't know about you, but I got a few texts that morning saying we heard that something happened in Orlando and in Boca. It turns out it was only in Orlando, but
scary. Well, we had that van.
Right.
Remember that drove by?
The Goyim Defense League.
The Goyim Defense League, yeah.
Right. But these guys are so filled with hate, their words and what they're screaming and yelling about.
Somebody sent me an email this week. I know we're going late here, but it's an important topic. They read my article last week about three reasons to teach the Holocaust and anti-Semitism and I spoke about confronting, standing up, and so on. And they wrote to me. I won't say which yeshiva they went to. Let's just say same as you. And they wrote to me saying that they were taught there that halacha, it's we know that we have a tradition that Esav sonas Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov. And because Esav hates Yaakov, so that the correct posture is anti-Semitism has always existed. It will always exist. And therefore, we should not defend ourselves, but sort of, you know, blend in, bow your head, don't stand up, don't confront, don't create more, just kind of pull back, go under the radar, let the anti-Semites scream, and do your best not to get killed. And I wrote back that I don't think there's any tradition like that. If that were the case, how does Israel right. have an army? Halachically, Israel shouldn't have an army. Don't irritate and don't aggravate the anti-Semites, because anti-Israel are anti-Semites. So I don't think we believe that. We don't believe that. And we believe that we have to defend ourselves against anti-Semitism. And part of the way we defend ourselves is to proactively stand up to it. Right. So whether we hold people accountable, take them to task, shine a spotlight, pass legislation, there are a whole bunch of ways that we actively or proactively defend ourselves. You could wait to defend yourself until you're being struck, or you can get up and you can defend yourself by acting in a proactive way. So interesting question. Goyim.tv. Anyone wants to watch the episode when they drove by us and also yelled at us that we should... They had a van that was... Their messaging was all off. On one side of the van, it said the Holocaust never happened. And the other side, it said Hitler should have finished you off.
Right.
If you're going to be a good anti-Semite, you got to get your messaging consistent, and you got to be good. So you want to really be shaken. If you want to be shaken, goyim.tv and watch that stories. So, and that's what the people in Orlando were promoting, which might be why people confused that our fact checker is texting me. That people might be confused because the Orlando guys were promoting the same website as the people who drove by and screamed at us, which is goyim.tv. So it's unfortunately an ongoing issue, and we'll have to keep talking about it. We interviewed, if you remember, the young man who was beaten on the streets of Manhattan.
But it's so interesting. Even after that happened, and it happened to someone just like you and me, nothing changed. Like we just go on as though it's not going to happen again. Right. And it will happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's time. Rabbi Brody, thank you for
stimulating
conversation.
It's fun tonight.
Great evening. We miss him. We're looking forward to welcoming Rabbi Moskowitz back. Please have in mind Esther Tehila Basara Tzipora, Carmiel Shai Ben Reza. We should hear only good news.
Amen.
We've got great guests lined up. Next week.
Can't wait.
Next week, a big guest, but can't announce it yet. But super excited. Best scholar in residence program in the world. Behind the Bima, every week. We're a shul that every single week has a scholar in residence.
Right.
It's pretty amazing.
And if you like the show, go on and give it a nice rating, because it's jumping up in the charts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Oh, I forgot I'm not supposed to say that anymore, but you can.
I'm saying.
Say it again. Say it again.
Everyone knows how to go. You just go on Apple, you go on your iPod, you give it a rating, five stars. Is that how you do it? Are we five stars? I don't know how many stars you can get. Absolutely. I mean, whatever, 10 stars. We're 10 stars.
All right, everyone. Till next time, stay happy, stay healthy, stay holy. We are out.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek Behind the Bima.